From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, Jonathan Broder, contributing editor for Congressional Quarterly, and I'm your moderator, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. Welcome, everyone, to Issues in the News, once again brought to you from remote locations, not in our usual studios on Capitol Hill, as we continue to practice safe social distancing during these extraordinary times. With that, here are the issues. The coronavirus pandemic continued to dominate the news, with new cases and fatalities still on the rise in many countries, and experts saying that stay-at-home orders and social distancing need to be maintained for the foreseeable future. The United States established itself as the epicenter of the crisis with more cases than any country in the world. We take a look at who is being affected and how the nation's leaders are responding. U.S. President Donald Trump fired two key oversight officials and sharply criticized a third, expressing once again his administration's disdain for independent oversight. Senator Bernie Sanders suspended his campaign for his party's presidential nomination, clearing the way for former Vice President Joe Biden to receive the nod. Panelists, welcome. Hope that you are all staying safe, staying healthy where you are. We know you're keeping up with the news, so thank you so much for your time and your expertise in doing this. We'll start off again with the coronavirus statistics. As of April 8th, we had globally 1,353,000 cases confirmed and over 79,000 deaths. Rate of infection and the rate of deaths still climbing in many countries, and the numbers literally change from moment to moment. Countries around the world still struggling with catastrophic conditions in some cases, while others are seeing the positive results, taking a firm early action. I'm going to start with you, Jonathan. We know about the measures that have been taken in the United States and other places, things like stay-at-home orders, social distancing. Have they been determined to be effective in, to use the term that the health officials use, flattening the curve of both cases diagnosed and fatalities?
The short answer is yes. The way that this virus spreads is through people. Once it gets into one person's body, it then spreads through droplets in that person's breath or in a sneeze or in a cough. And it basically can affect someone who is anywhere between 3 and 6 feet away. So it's very, very, very contagious. And really the only way to flatten the curve, as they say, is to practice social distancing, where people wear masks, where they don't go out, they don't come into contact with each other. And it is working. We're seeing the first signs that the hopeful signs that the rate of infection, at least in the United States, is beginning to go down. But as everyone has seen, the peak contagion of this virus spreads around the country at different times. So at one point, it's New York is suffering the worst, and now it's apparently moving to places like Washington, D.C., where we are.
And Kimberly, I'll go to you. As we see the pandemic expressing itself across the United States, we hear the stories about facilities needing more ventilators, needing more protective gear for first line defenders against this thing, doctors and other emergency room workers, things like that. Are facilities getting what they need? And if they aren't, who's bears the responsibility for that?
You know, this has been one of the big stories that has really been developing this week, just as sort of states and local governments and even hospitals are finally, you know, getting to the point where they can say, all right, we've got some funding, we've got agreement to go ahead and just spend whatever we have to get the supplies. And now there are some companies that are starting to ramp up production. And that supply chain, after it starts and fits, is finally getting going. And now there seems to be this bottleneck, logjam, weird thing happening where even when states and local governments think they have some masks coming in or ventilators coming in, it's getting routed through private corporations or getting moved from place to place. And there really is a lack of clarity from the federal government on who's getting what and why and in what order. And a lot of states are complaining, saying that in some cases, the federal government is even taking supplies that they have purchased. And it's fascinating because we had a few weeks where states were, you know, begging the federal government to step in and organize distribution of supplies to, you know, kind of force private companies to manufacture these goods. And now we're in a place where they've kind of given up on that and are still trying to make it happen on their own. But even that seems to still be a struggle. We had a kind of wild move from California's governor, Gavin Newsom, this week, saying he was going to set up a coalition of states to try to leverage their bargaining power to purchase necessary medical supplies, prompting a million dark jokes on social media about, gee, if only we had some sort of system in place where groups of states could act together, which is effectively what a federal government in the United States of America is supposed to be.
Right. Jonathan, I'll let you weigh in on the same question, because and in terms of, we hate to put politics into this, but we have to if we're going to look at it reasonably, because I think the president injects politics, or seems to inject politics in it as well. Your take, is there a problem? It seems that there's a part of the country that feels that there isn't a problem at all, according to polling. There's a part of the electorate that feels that there's a huge problem as far as polling is concerned. But isn't it the fact that the only constituency that matters is that group of people that actually needs the medical equipment, that is the doctors and the patients?
Well, there's sort of a split screen here, because the administration, the president in his daily briefings, claims everything is just going along swimmingly, that everyone is getting what they want. He constantly is reeling off figures of how many masks are being produced and how many gowns and ventilators.
And testing, famously. But
at the same time, and this is the other side of the split screen, the governors and local officials are saying, we're not seeing this stuff. Moreover, when they try to obtain it themselves, they find themselves bidding against other states. And then, as you mentioned, the federal government sometimes comes in and bids against all of them, or presents a price that is a price that the states can't compete with. You hear stories of a state securing a supply of, let's say, masks or some kind of protective gear, and then they are informed that another state or the federal government outbid them. So they don't get it. They don't get those supplies. So there's a big discrepancy between what the administration is saying is the situation and what the actual situation is on the ground.
And Jonathan, I'm going to stay with you for one more question, which is, the president has powers that he has not universally invoked in terms of directing companies to create and produce certain materials at certain numbers and at certain prices. Why hasn't he done so? Especially a president who is usually so eager to express the powers of the office, why has he not taken advantage of every opportunity to express that power when it comes to this situation?
We only know what the president has said himself, and that is that the law called the Defense Production Act, that's one of the powers that you were referring to. It gives the president the power to order industries to produce certain things. What the president says is that the United States isn't that kind of a country, where what he said was, we don't nationalize our industries. Now, there's a big difference between nationalizing an industry and the Defense Production Act, where the president, in a time of emergency, orders a company to produce a certain product for the good of and security of the country. But what Trump is saying is that this smacks of nationalization, and that's not the kind of country we are.
I'm going to go to you, Kimberly, because as we get more cases and we get more information about who is being affected by the coronavirus, especially here in the United States, I'm going to focus on this because a story has emerged and a pattern has emerged where the African-American community in the United States seems to be disproportionately affected, both in terms of number of cases and in terms of the fatality rates. As you look at those numbers, we see those numbers, which were shocking in some cases, I must admit, to see the disparity of the effect on the African-American community. What does that tell us about who is being affected by coronavirus, and I guess the societies of the people that are being affected in them? Does it say more about the disease or more about the society in which it hits most viciously?
Oh, I think it definitely says something about the pre-existing economic and health disparities in the United States. I'm from St. Louis, Missouri, and the hometown newspaper, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, had a story yesterday that said every single coronavirus death in St. Louis was an African-American so far.
Wow.
every single one, even though lots of people have been sick. The people who are disproportionately dying, it seems, especially in concentrated urban areas, are definitely skewing black and brown. If you look in New York City, it's definitely skewing black and brown in terms of African Americans and Hispanics. This really speaks to who is able to do the social distancing and who has the highest risk of exposure to this disease. Low-wage workers, healthcare workers, grocery store workers, delivery drivers, food service workers, the people who still have to be out and about and are considered essential workers do tend to skew towards black and brown people in America. And those who are able to work from home, stay in, and order things in to be delivered by that same group definitely are able to protect themselves a little bit more. Now, if you layer on top of who is doing these low-wage jobs and layer on top of that who has access to health care, who is more likely to be uninsured and scared to go to the doctor because you're worried about racking up all of these bills. Unlike many countries in the United States, if you get sick from COVID-19, you know, it's still not 100% clear who's going to be paying your health care bills. And medical bankruptcies are a huge issue in the United States. And not only that, but especially when you look at big cities, black and brown people are much more likely to live in smaller accommodations, to be renting as opposed to living in single family homes, to be in shared accommodations, which means that you are even at even higher risk. So if you're living in an apartment building as opposed to a single family home, you have a higher risk of exposure to COVID-19. If you are living in a house, but you're living with a couple generations of a family and somebody has to go out and work as a home health care aide or as a janitor or as a delivery driver to help keep paying the bills, it's increasing your risk of exposure. And so you have all of these various layers of the way the American economy works that just all pile one on top of the other to make this group more at risk. And Dr. Anthony Fauci, in some of these press briefings, has said, look, we're not going to be able to solve these systemic disparities in health care this month. We just have to focus on trying to provide extra protection or convince people in this group to engage in social distancing. But it's a real challenge.
The thought that keeps resonating in my head is a comment that you made some weeks ago, which is that I'll never forget it, where you said, what you get so much depends on what you have.
And also in this case, this is something that was predicted by leaders in the African American community several weeks ago when it became clear that being able to maintain social distancing was going to be sort of what made or break your level of risk. There were a lot of people who spoke up early saying, wait a second, the people who still have to go to work fit into a particular demographic, and this is going to be a problem. And now we're seeing the real life consequences of that.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back with more Issues in the News. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now, back to our panel, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, and Jonathan Broder, contributing editor for Congressional Quarterly, and I'm your moderator, Michael Williams. Jonathan, I'm going to go over to you as we sort of finish this coronavirus arc, if you will. You had mentioned earlier that President Trump is still holding his daily press conferences, which are part information and part airing of grievances, if you will. And I guess it changes from day to day about where the slider on that scale lands. Some days it's much more of one than the other. But it seems that there is a pattern of choosing targets to share blame, responsibility, what have you, other than the administration for what is going on, both in terms of why it got here, how it got here, how long it's been here, and when it's going to end. Latest target seems to be the World Health Organization, where the president has been threatening to withhold funding for what he claims is mismanagement and misinformation by that organization. Just give me a rundown on what's going on there.
Well, a lot of this has to do with Trump's leadership style. Trump, he likes to have an enemy or an opponent that he can blame for shortcomings in the administration. So in order to deflect attention away from those shortcomings, he first blamed China. Now, it's true that China, at least in the initial stages of the outbreak of the virus in the city of Wuhan, they were slow to be transparent. They suppressed numbers of cases, and they attacked doctors in China that were trying to raise the flag and alert the country to the problem. But the Chinese very quickly turned things around, and because it's an authoritarian government, they were able to take measures that free societies have much more difficulty implementing, like stay-at-home regulations. In China, if you were to go out on the street, there would be drones with loudspeakers on them that would immediately see you and order you back into your house. So Trump, at first, was blaming China. Then, when it was made clear to him that the United States is actually dependent on China to get the personal protection equipment that it needs, Trump softened his tone, and now he's blaming the WHO. So there's a pattern here of deflecting attention from the government's own botched performance here in responding to the virus to put that on outside factors. I would also add that you mentioned these daily briefings as being part information, but they're also, I would say, sort of campaign rallies. I mean, Trump insists on coming out every day to lead these briefings. And the general message is everything is going along fine. We're doing a great job. And he criticizes those who don't praise him enough. So there's that as well.
Kimberly, before we leave, I would be remiss without going to you for your take on how this is all affecting the economy. I believe that the latest reports say that another, 6.6 million people have filed this week, just this past week alone, for unemployment insurance. It seems as though some of the markets are taking a bounce up, but the pain certainly is still being felt within the population. What is the situation now in the short and long-term outlook here for the economy?
It's an unmitigated disaster. It's terrible out here. Restaurant workers, factory workers, retail workers, so many people are out of work and trying to get benefits, hoping to get these stimulus checks that the U.S. government is promising people who are out of work. But we basically shut down the economy, you know, in many, many places. And one of the things that makes it so challenging, both for small businesses and individuals, is that it's still not entirely clear how long this is going to last. So small businesses that are struggling to stay open and trying to decide what bills to pay don't really have an end date from which they can plan. Now, the latest round of stimulus that provides loans for small businesses was supposed to help, but then, you know, on the rollout last week, you had many, many banks that were not prepared and many, many banks that didn't want to participate. And then lots of stories of, you know, banks kind of picking and choosing which small businesses they were going to work with. And that reinforced some of these economic disparities, even among business owners that we've talked about along demographic lines. You know, the federal government, Congress, and the Treasury Department are scrambling to come up with programs to provide sort of a backstop to the economy, or at least to create a situation under which there can be a recovery. But this is like nothing we've ever seen in the economy. And it is very challenging to put into words the scale of the hit, because not everyone is feeling it equally, for sure. But the people who are feeling it, it's terrifying for them.
Indeed. I think scary, terrifying, challenging, these are all words that we're becoming very familiar with when we talk about this particular subject, this coronavirus outbreak, which is, again, is something that we have not experienced in our lifetime, certainly. I want to move on to a topic of the oversight of the Trump administration. Inspectors general perform an essential oversight role in the federal government. They are the watchdogs, the truth tellers, truth sayers within the government. And President Trump dismissed two of those officials in key positions. One, Michael Atkinson, the intelligence community whistleblower who delivered the Ukraine whistleblower report to Congress. I say he's the intelligence community IG who delivered the Ukraine whistleblower report to Congress, and also Glenn Fine, who is the Defense Department IG, who was the chair of the panel overseeing $2 trillion of relief appropriated by Congress. And you also had the president sharply criticizing Christy Grimm, a deputy IG at Health and Human Services, which issued a report reporting widespread shortages of hospital supplies, in contradiction to what President Trump was saying in briefings. Jonathan, I'll go to you. The firings, I know that they seem to be legal. Are they justified? And what's been the response of the two parties?
Very interesting. They are legal. The president does have the authority to do this. What we've seen from the president is a determination or a prickliness, a sensitivity to any kind of criticism of his performance. In the case of Atkinson, as you mentioned, he was the one who passed on this whistleblower's complaint to Congress. It seems that his firing was done in retaliation. The explanation that the president gave for Atkinson's firing was that he had lost confidence in him. What's interesting is that Republicans in Congress, along with Democrats, so it's bipartisan, are basically challenging the president on this. And they're coming to him and saying, I'm sorry, the explanation that you've given that you've lost confidence is not sufficient for the firing of Atkinson, and we need a more detailed explanation. In the case of Glenn Fine, this was a commission that was being set up to oversee the distribution of this $2.2 trillion. Trump doesn't want any oversight, so he got rid of Fine, and he's appointed, or at least nominated, someone else to, well, someone who is a bit more politically acceptable to him, to oversee that commission. So what you're left with basically is the congressional committees that oversee the president and the executive branch normally. They are basically going to have the lion's share of overseeing this distribution of funds. And the problem is that while this committee will have subpoena power, the president has shown that he just ignores congressional subpoenas. It's very unclear where the oversight is going to be coming from.
Kimberly, do you have anything you wanted to add there?
As Jonathan just said, we have a quite a track record of the president in ignoring congressional oversight. So I don't really know what a strongly worded letter is going to do at this point.
Move on to the suspension of the campaign of Bernie Sanders, which in other times would have been our lead story, possibly. In a speech that was televised live across the United States, U.S. presidential candidate Bernie Sanders suspended his campaign, leaving former Vice President Joe Biden as the presumptive nominee of the Democratic Party. Very quickly, he said in his speech, so while we are winning the ideological battle, and while we are winning the support of so many young people and working people throughout the country, I have concluded that this battle for the Democratic nomination will not be successful. So today I'm announcing the suspension of my campaign. Kimberly, I'll just ask you in two simple words. What happened?
The revolution stopped, the Sanders revolution, as he called it. He had some early successes, for sure, and he definitely had the strong mobilization of the youth and some particular groups in terms of early turnout. But he ran into a wall in South Carolina, and then with Black voters turning out overwhelmingly for Biden, Black voters are a huge part of the Democratic base. And then the coronavirus outbreak happened. And this pandemic has just changed everything. Both of the campaigns had to stop their campaigning. They had to stop most of their rallies and activities, even though the numbers were looking bad for Sanders even before the pandemic really shut everything down. But the fact that he needed to be in the Senate while Biden could continue campaigning if he needed to, and the fact that, as Sanders pointed out in his speech, the risk of continuing to have a divided Democratic Party in this particular environment was just more than people could politically handle on the left. And so he decided to suspend his campaign. But what's interesting in his speech is that he did not give up his delegates. He did not sort of give a rousing endorsement of Biden. And he said that he wanted to continue to gain support in the primaries that remain so that he could have more of a say in the Democratic convention that's coming up in the summer in an attempt to sort of shape the party platform. So it will be interesting to see how he chooses to wield the power that he is preserving for himself despite suspending his campaign.
Jonathan, to you really quickly, do you believe that Joe Biden can absorb the votes, if not the enthusiasm, of the Sanders campaign?
That is the big question. Even though Sanders said that he would throw his support behind Biden, there's a question as to whether the Bernie bros, as they're called, the Bernie supporters, will throw their support behind Biden. In other words, will the party be able to unify behind Biden? That's still an open question.
It is indeed. That's all the time we have for this week. Thanks to our wonderful panel, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, and Jonathan Broder, contributing editor for Congressional Quarterly. This program is produced by VOA's Kim Lewis, and I'm Michael Williams. Please stay safe, and thanks for listening.